8 Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how a Wisconsin tribe is working to restore and conserve wetland habitats near Green Bay. First, many Republicans in the U.S. Senate say they won't support a proposed plan for an independent investigation of the January 6th events at the nation's capital. The week in Washington, we'll check in on efforts to establish a bipartisan commission to investigate the Capitol attacks, along with some of the other big stories in national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see a bipartisan commission on January 6th move forward? How would you feel if it doesn't? Why do you think it's needed or not needed in your view? What would you want to see them look at if this existed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back with you.
All right. This thing passed the House. First of all, give us some background, Scott, on what happened in the House, the negotiations that led to the current makeup of this legislation.
Well, this is a 9/11 style commission, similar to the bipartisan independent commission that was created in the wake of the 9/11 attacks back in 2001. And, you know, it's been a long road. I mean, talks first started for January 6th commission shortly after the attack on the Capitol that day. And, you know, the calls for such a commission were from both sides of the aisle. Now, those talks had broken down after Nancy Pelosi laid out some of her demands that she wanted this to be more of a Democratic heavy commission, more Democrats than Republicans, because they control the levers of power in Washington. You know, she did tip it more towards the Democrats, but in recent weeks, as the impasse had continued, she began to give in to some of the Republican demands, including having this really be a equally balanced commission, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, appointed by the leaders of the Congress, the 4 leaders. And secondly, that this would be a commission that where Democrats and Republicans would have equal subpoena power to call witnesses under oath. And so because of those concessions that Nancy Pelosi gave to Republicans, nearly 3 dozen signed on last week and voted with all of the Democrats in a big bipartisan vote to establish this commission. That included the 10 Republicans who voted to impeach Donald Trump for his role in sort of egging on that pro-Trump mob on January 6th, but also a number of, you know, more institutionalists on the Republican side of the aisle who believe that Congress needs to have some sort of formal record to study the events leading up to January 6th and then what happened in terms of the breakdown in security on that day. And that leads us to where we are right now, which is now Chuck Schumer has teed up a vote in the United States Senate for tomorrow. This would be a test vote. Right now, things are not looking so great because of a number of dynamics at play.
Right. Let's talk about that. This is one of them Senate votes where really the threshold is 60 under the filibuster rules as they exist. What are the prospects for getting Republicans to join in with the 50 Democrats to hit that threshold?
Right. So that magic number that Democrats are looking at is 10 Republicans that they will need to break that Republican filibuster. Right now, only 2 Republicans, Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, have signed on and said they will be yes votes. But again, they need 10. And, you know, even some of the 7 Republicans who voted to convict Donald Trump in his impeachment trial are saying they will not be supporting this legislation. That includes Richard Burr of North Carolina. Others are on the fence and still trying to work their way through this bill. One of those is Susan Collins, who's negotiating with some moderates on the other side of the aisle, like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, on some tweaks and amendments to the legislation. Namely, she wants to ensure that there are that Republicans have the ability to hire and name staff who will really will be doing the bulk of the investigative work on in for this commission. And so there, you know, some things are still in flux and up in the air, but when you sort of take a step back and look at it, it's really difficult to see how Democrats will get 10 Republicans to cross the aisle and support this thing, especially when Mitch McConnell has called the legislation slanted and unbalanced. He said yesterday that he'd rather focus on what Joe Biden is doing, you know, in his administration, rather than looking backwards at the 2020 election and the events of January 6th. So that's sort of where we are in the Senate right now. It doesn't look good for the prospects of this bill.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the possibility of a January 6th commission and looking ahead, more infrastructure. 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Richard is with us in Milwaukee. Richard, hi.
Hi. This totally floors me why people like Senator Johnson and others, senators in other states, would not be in favor of this commission. If they really think that it, and sincerely think that it's just involved tourists or Antifa or whatever, you'd think they would want a commission to vindicate them. As it is, all the time they're being mocked for their outrageous statements about it, but I suspect that they knowingly are lying through their teeth and don't really want to find out the truth.
Richard, thanks for the call. Richard, referring to Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, talking about the mostly peaceful protest, a Republican congressman whose name I can't remember right now, saying they were behaving like tourists inside the White House, inside the Capitol, excuse me. Scott, can you talk about some more of that strain of Republican argument when it comes to the January 6th events?
Well, that strain of Republicanism is really aligned with Donald Trump, you know, are some of his most fervent supporters in the Congress, including, as a caller mentioned, Senator Johnson. The congressman you're referring to, Andrew Clyde, is a freshman from Georgia, a Republican, who also is a big supporter of Donald Trump. And so a lot of the Trump supporters, their argument, well, number one, they've had some pretty jarring statements in recent weeks, you know, calling some of the rioters who obviously were violent and injuring police officers, as was captured in numerous videos, calling, you know, some of them tourists, or saying that they were no more harmful than tourists. Those have been pretty jarring statements for people like myself and other journalists and other lawmakers who were in the Capitol that day, who personally witnessed some of the violence and saw the injuries firsthand and saw, you know, police officers in real agony and pain. But, you know, some of their arguments has been that there are numerous investigations underway. And that's the big point that they are making, is that there are congressional committees, at least a half a dozen on both sides of the Capitol, that are already digging into various aspects of January 6th. In fact, we will be getting some reports back from some of those committees in the coming weeks. Also, another argument we've heard is that the FBI has already made hundreds of you know, arrests and has charged people in some of these crimes, and they are slowly and methodically working their way through these cases, and prosecutions will be obviously the next step here. And so that's been the argument from many of the Republicans who are opposed to a January 6th commission, is that there are, you know, already investigations underway from both the executive branch and the FBI and the congressional legislative branch.
And Scott, before we move on from this topic, you mentioned that the Republican argument against the commission is we should be looking at the current president and moving forward, not looking back. But you wrote recently that former President Trump is making it harder to do that, still in his statements focusing on the 2020 election. We've got the audit-like thing going on in Arizona. A lot of Republicans definitely wanting to still focus on the 2020 election. Can you talk about that balancing act?
Yeah, it really undercuts the argument from McConnell to say we want to look forward. We want to focus on what they see as the dangerous, radical policies of President Biden, when the leader of their party, Donald Trump, is still putting out statements, really multiple statements a day. If you look on his blog, raising concerns about the 2020 election. In fact, he's still very much focused on the 2020 election. Almost everything is aimed towards raising doubt about the election last fall. And so it's put Republicans in a very difficult spot. And the other thing I would just point out quickly is that because it looks like Republicans are going to balk at this effort to form an independent outside commission, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats have threatened to create then, what they call a special select committee that would be much more partisan. Certainly, Nancy Pelosi would get to pick the members on her side of the aisle. It would favor the Democrats. But that committee, similar to the Benghazi committee before the 2016 election, could go on, this year as well as next year into the midterm election year, which could create headaches for Republicans.
We're talking to Scott Wong. He covers House leadership for The Hill. He's with us today to talk about the latest on negotiations over an infrastructure package and other top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The president came down on his number. Senate Republicans have moved up a little on their number. Do you want to see something happen when it comes to infrastructure spending from Congress and the president? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk now about the top stories in national politics with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. He covers House leadership. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about ongoing, never-ending negotiations on infrastructure spending. Scott, we need like a little mini theme song because we talk about this every week. Still negotiations, right? Still things going on. They're still talking about infrastructure. What's happening?
Well, there's a lot of talks that are still going on. Number one, you have the talks between Republican Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia and the White House. She's the lead negotiator for Republicans. And that's where we're seeing these offers being traded that you mentioned. Shelley Moore Capito's last offer was up from $800 billion. It's now about $1 trillion over 8 years. The last White House offer we saw was about $1.7 trillion from a few days ago. So they're about $700 billion off. A lot of money, a lot of distance between the two sides, and a lot of impatience on Capitol Hill. A lot of progressives are growing impatient. We're also seeing a separate group that has recently emerged in the last few days, led by some familiar faces, Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Rob Portman, on the Republican side, on the Democrat side, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, along with John Tester. And so they're calling, this is sort of the plan B group. If talks break down between the White House and Shelley Moore Capito, then this group is looking to pick things up and put it back together and hopefully come to some sort of deal. This second group, the plan B group, is really focused on how you pay for such an infrastructure package. And a couple of those ideas is to tie the gas tax to inflation. These are some old ideas we've been hearing for a long time, but they keep coming up again and again. Another idea is to have electric vehicle owners contribute to the gas tax, perhaps through a mileage tax, because as you know, electric vehicle owners don't pay for gas. So these are some ideas they're kicking around. You know, going back to what I said earlier about the progressives, they feel like time is of the essence. They feel like the public is on the Democrat side and is behind Joe Biden, particularly on this issue of infrastructure. It's a popular issue for the American public. And so progressives are saying, look, you know, we can't delay any longer and keep talking and talking to Republicans. We need to act, and we need to act in a big, bold way. They like that $2.3 trillion plan that Biden initially proposed. But Biden is somebody who's spent his entire lifetime working across the aisle, and he's not ready to throw in the towel on these bipartisan talks.
On the subject of how to pay for it, Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware was on NPR this morning talking about the negotiations. Here's some of the talk about paying for a plan.
Last year, we passed on a bipartisan basis $4 trillion in pandemic relief and recovery. I think in the end, a lot of this infrastructure bill will use some of the previously appropriated funds that went to states, and some of it will just not be paid for if we want to get it done on a bipartisan basis.
Now, I understand at some points President Biden said he wanted it all paid for. He was hoping to do it by scrapping some of the 2017 tax cuts passed by Republicans. Republicans say we're not going to do that. So how important is it to everybody, Scott, to say, OK, if we're spending X amount on infrastructure, we raise an equal amount of revenue?
Yeah, to roll back the 2017 Trump tax cuts, Mitch McConnell has said that's a non-starter for his side of the aisle. And that's why you've seen in recent days this new idea of what Chris Coons was talking about, unused COVID relief funds that could be somehow transferred to pay for infrastructure and transportation spending. It's an interesting idea. You know, as the economy starts to heat back up, although, you know, it's sort of been touch and go, the idea is that maybe there will be some leftover unused COVID relief funds that could be transferred over for infrastructure spending. So, you know, it remains to be seen. I think Biden and his team, that there's a struggle inside the White House whether or not to keep talking, keep negotiating. You know, there's Democrats who were there in 2009 who are part of the Obama White House who have a long memory and remember how Republicans continue to try to negotiate on Obamacare, and people. At the end of the day, you know, Republican votes were not there, and Democrats felt that they wasted a lot of time negotiating with Republicans when in the end, Democrats had to go it alone on Obamacare. And so there's a feeling, you know, let's just not waste any more time. Let's just use the budget reconciliation process. Like they did with the COVID relief earlier this year. Let's use it again and pass this thing with Democratic votes only, and let's end the bipartisan talks.
Talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national news. I want to turn to one more, Scott, before our half hour passes us by. Republican member of Congress, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, some of her fellow Republicans talking about maybe ousting her from their caucus, or if not that, at least criticism over recent statements. What is going on?
Yeah, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been in the headlines, it seems, the entire year since her arrival on Capitol Hill. You know, the latest comment she made was equating mask requirements on the House floor and this idea of vaccine passports to the Nazis' treatment of the Jews during World War II, obviously, which she's talking about the Holocaust, the death and murder of 6 million Jews during that war. And so obviously that has created enormous outrage on both sides of the aisle. It was the rare instance where we've seen the Republican leaders rebuke one of their own, Marjorie Taylor Greene. Kevin McCarthy called her comments wrong and appalling. Mitch McConnell called them outrageous and reprehensible. Adam Kinzinger, a fellow Republican, says, let's kick her out of the Republican conference. That's something that they can do with a simple vote. If you remember, Marjorie Taylor Greene was stripped of her committee assignments earlier this year by the Democrats for social media posts that promoted violence against Democratic leaders, as well as some really wild conspiracy theories. But the problem, you know, I talked to a couple Republicans yesterday who said the problem is that the votes probably would not be there to punish Marjorie Taylor Greene, to kick her out of the conference, even though that's precisely, you know, what they did to Liz Cheney in stripping her of her leadership position just a couple weeks ago for continuing to criticize Donald Trump. So, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, this fight between Republicans and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Republicans and Liz Cheney comes down to, you know, Donald Trump and the Republicans' support for Donald Trump. And because Marjorie Taylor Greene is one of his strongest allies in Congress, I think there's a lot of Republicans that are very reluctant to go up against her, because essentially it will be seen as going up against Donald Trump, who remains enormously popular to this day in the Republican Party.
And we'll leave it there for this week. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Take care.
That's Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill. He was with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. Coming up after the news, Oneida Nation Chairman Tahasi Hill tells us about the tribe's efforts to restore wetlands on their tribal lands west of Green Bay. You can follow all of our conversations here on Central Time and across the Ideas Network at WPR.org, or you can download the WPR app and listen on your smartphone and check out archives whenever you want. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at a private company's efforts to meet the demand for broadband access in much of rural Wisconsin. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. First, Kim Ng of the Miami Marlins became the first female general manager in Major League Baseball last year. Then Bianca Smith was hired by the Boston Red Sox as the first black woman to coach for an MLB club. She was previously the hitting coordinator for Carroll University in Waukesha. Megan Hart has more on two Brewers staffers who are part of a growing trend in Major League Baseball.
On April 1st, fans returned to American Family Field for the first time in more than a year, and the Milwaukee Brewers mounted a thrilling come-from-behind victory over the Minnesota Twins. Here's the call from Bally Sports Wisconsin.
And Arcia, big bouncing ball. Kane's coming to the plate. It's glove to throw home. It's slide. He's safe. Ball game.
For Teresa Lau, it was a big day for another reason, too. It was the first time the athletic trainer heard her name announced as a major league staffer.
That's kind of where it hit me, where it really sunk in that I actually achieved this goal, and it's only the beginning for my career right now.
Back in 2017, she went looking for an internship in professional baseball after a male classmate landed one in Cleveland.
And I thought to myself, well, if he could do it, I could do it.
She ended up with the Boston Red Sox. The next year, she joined the Brewers as minor league physical therapist and then rehab coordinator. Now she works with players at the very top of the game, and she says they've made it easy for her to settle into her new role.
We travel together, we're family, we're in it together, and it could be a long, tough season, so we got to make sure we have each other's back.
Her advice for aspiring athletic trainers: master the basics and then make them your own. Lau says mentors have helped her along the way, too. They include Nancy Patterson, a former athletic trainer for the Los Angeles Dodgers, the first woman to hold the job in MLB history. And now, Lau is among a growing number of women who are breaking new ground in professional baseball, including her good friend Sarah Goodrum.
The responsibilities in my new role as the hitting coordinator is I oversee the minor league hitting space.
She joined the Brewers in 2017. Now she's the first woman to oversee developmental hitting for a major league organization, though she says she never viewed her gender as a factor in her career.
It was like, if I want to do something, like, I believe in myself to be able to do it. And I'm also just thankful that I was able to join an organization that also believed in me, too.
She helped the Brewers create their sports science department before taking on her current role. Now she works with young players, from teenagers at the team's academy in the Dominican Republic to pros on the verge of their MLB debut.
Sometimes I have to pinch myself and realize like how cool it is that I get to help young athletes, you know, pursue their dreams of making it to the major leagues.
She says there's always a feeling out period when you work with someone new, but beyond that, it doesn't seem to make a difference to players that she's a woman. They know she's there to improve their game. And she's not thinking every day about what it means to be a woman in her job.
It's about controlling the controllable. And for me, what's in my control is, you know, how I treat people on a day in and day out basis, and making sure that I'm as prepared as possible.
It's a mentality she learned during her own time as a softball player. A couple hours northwest of American Family Field, Lauren Clowder plays the sport for Seymour High School. The Thunder won a state championship in 2019 before last season was canceled due to COVID-19. Now they're back on the diamond. And the Brewers fan says she's happy to see more women on the field during baseball games.
I think it's amazing. Like, I think that women are, like, really powerful and they're, like, an inspiration to a lot of people.
Her teammate Kylie Vanden Langenberg agrees.
Seeing women in sort of a man's workplace is always inspiring. You know, it makes me want to work a little bit harder for what I want to be and who I want to be when I grow up.
Both Lau and Goodrum say it's important to them to be good role models, and Goodrum offers this advice to girls who aspire to careers in men's professional sports.
You know what it's like to grow up as a girl and go through everything, and sometimes confidence can be lost, but it's the most important thing for a woman to have if they want to work in sports, in my opinion.
And now there are more women than ever showing what's possible. Megan Hart, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, Wisconsin and the country as a whole have lost a lot of wetland environments over the decades. Wetlands play a huge role in ecosystems by maintaining water quality. There are efforts to conserve and restore these wetlands around the country, and a long-term project on the Oneida Nation Reservation west of Green Bay is focusing on key watershed areas that can have a big impact on water quality, wildlife habitat, and pollution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live in a part of the state that has a lot of wetlands? Are they healthy? Is your community working to manage those, to restore and conserve them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Tehasi Hill is chairman of the Oneida Nation. Chairman Hill, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Can you start us off with a look at the origins of this this ongoing long-term project to work on wetlands on tribal land near Green Bay?
Yeah, sure, definitely. I think, you know, it's decades in the making here in Oneida anyway. Is probably the early 90s when we were able to have sufficient funds to be able to acquire our reservation lands back and be able to implement restoration programs that have that we've built on one another over the years to have a much larger impact in our wetlands across the Oneida Nation.
And a recent video that came out in association with, I think, the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, you mentioned how important partnership has been in this project. Can you talk about the different hands that you're working with here?
Yes, definitely. It's a very important aspect of pretty much any restoration work done pretty much anywhere. And we're lucky enough here in Oneida to be the headwaters to the south branch of the Suamico River. And so being able to do work on the headwaters and bring that system back online, and then having partners, you know, off the reservation, different local conservationist groups, environmentalists, and along with state partners like the DNR and federal partners like the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Army Corps of Engineers. I think these are all very important aspects to be able to get a wetland functioning as it should, and being able to restore those areas and to provide habitat for wildlife and spawning areas for fish. And I think it's a great endeavor.
On a practical level, what does it take to rebuild a wetland in a headwaters area like that?
Well, we've gone through several, I guess, different aspects of it. For one, the headwaters of the South Branch of the Suamico River, that was an area that was heavily ditched and drained for agricultural use, and caused water flow issues, and then also negative water quality issues, such as farm runoff into the water basin and out to the Bay of Green Bay. And so being able to engineer land structures to retain that water at several different levels to be able to allow nature to do its job and filter that water before discharging downstream and ultimately out to the bay.
What has led to the loss of wetlands in that part of the state? Is it mostly conversion for agriculture?
Yeah, initially conversion for agriculture. So obviously Wisconsin being a large dairy state, much of it is row crops, corn and beans and hay, silage for feeding the dairy industry. But then, eventually that's being followed by urban sprawl as well. So I think if things were allowed to progress, things would have continued to deteriorate. And so being able to acquire large tracts of land and going through the process to determine their best use based on, the soil qualities and the hydrology and forest land as well, determining whether that's suitable to, build on for housing or commercial or keep it agriculture. So it's a process to do that evaluation and make those determinations.
Can you kind of paint us a picture of what it's like now to visit some of these areas that are further along in the wetland restoration? What's it like just to be there now?
Yeah, it's quite a dramatic change. Being primarily agricultural fields, would have seen the different farming practices, generally tilling and kind of bare soil during spring and winter and fall. And to now having a large wetland complex with open water, thousands of migratory birds, even other upland species of birds like pheasants, and then also of course deer really seem to thrive in these areas of both kind of a mixed habitat of wetland, forest, and agricultural land. So it allows a great variety of wildlife in these areas as well, and it's definitely a sight to see.
We're looking at wetlands restoration and a project on the Oneida Nation Reservation with Tehasi Hill, chairman of the Oneida Nation. Long-term project there, restoring and then conserving wetland areas that are in a headwaters that ultimately feeds into the Bay of Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved in a wetland restoration project yourself, this one or elsewhere in the state or beyond? Do you have questions about the United Nations efforts to restore these wetlands? And do you live on one of Wisconsin's more famous ones, maybe? What do you think about the wildlife you see there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Oneida Nation Chairman Tehasi Hill about wetland restoration on the Oneida Reservation, long-term project there in headwaters that ultimately feed into the Bay of Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest or experience in your community, maybe with a wetland conservation or preservation project. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Chairman Hill, I saw in a video, you're thinking about this project as a very long-term thing. This is not a quick fix sort of thing. Can you talk about the long time horizon you're looking at here?
Yeah, definitely. I think any time, obviously, it's taken many, many decades to have many wetlands be degraded to where they're at now or be drained. And so it's going to take a long time to make those repairs and let nature retake those areas and do the job that they're intended, you know, to clean those waters and to provide, you know, habitat for wildlife. And so, you know, this is probably, you know, still several more decades of continued work. And then as we acquire more land within the nation's boundaries and being able to, again, assess those lands and determine the best use and, be able to potentially provide more wetland restoration projects as time goes on. And those projects, you know, do have that long-lasting effect. You know, it also another project was our Trout Creek restoration project, again, where we were able to eventually be able to, after many decades, be able to reintroduce Trout Creek back into this waterway on the reservation that was really degraded by agricultural practices for many decades.
And you mentioned the wildlife you've seen there. Are there opportunities now for people who live in the area? Maybe, I don't know if tourism is part of the goal here to enjoy these restored landscapes.
Yeah, there's definitely opportunities. There is designated areas for, you know, public viewing on the reservation of certain areas. But some of the areas are, you know, sensitive, environmentally sensitive, whether it be the habitat itself or wildlife, nesting birds and such, that much of the area is still closed. But I think eventually, as we get a better handle on things, and that's definitely something that's in the realm of possibilities for that wildlife viewing. And even now, most of the areas that have been worked on are quite, you can view them from, you know, public road access areas to be able to see, you know, the hundreds or thousands of birds in an area, or see them take off in the sprint in the early morning hours and return in the evening from feeding. You know, so there's definitely opportunities for bird watching and other wildlife.
You mentioned water control as part of the benefits here, and I know at least elsewhere wetlands can be a big part of preventing floods in different areas. Is that part of the story here too?
Yeah, it definitely is. Oneida has enacted a shoreline protection ordinance quite some time ago, and where we wouldn't build the main watershed that runs through our reservation is Duck Creek. And so we don't build within so many feet of that area, again, because it's generally going to be a floodplain. And anytime you build in floodplains, you just kind of compound that flooding issue by either diverting water to other areas or having your property flooded. And so we feel that, again, you know, building in floodland areas is not practical and ill-advised. And so we tried our best over the years to assure that where we do build, people hopefully will not have regular seasonal flooding issues.
We're talking to Oneida Nation Chairman Tehasi Hill, looking at a wetland restoration project on tribal lands. This is west of Green Bay, headwaters that ultimately feed into the Bay of Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Steve?
You know, when I look at a wetland, it was an area where in the turn of the century, all the farmers around that area would own 20 acres or 40 acres down in that wetlands area. And then in the dry time of the year, that's where they would cut their marsh grass. And so that wetlands would work like a sponge. In the spring and the wet times, it would hold the moisture. And then in the summer, it would dry out. And then when the rains came again, it was dry out. It was dry, and it was able to hold moisture again to keep the water from running right into the creeks or the rivers. And then it would work its way through that sponge or through that wetland, and that's how it would clean and then slowly release it back to the creeks and the rivers. And what I'm seeing on the wetlands restorations, it seems like they're going in and damming them areas up and digging these scrapes and stuff. So now instead of being a sponge, it's almost like a lake. And they hold this water, and then when the rains come, it can't move through the sponge. Once the sponge
gotcha, is dead, Steve. I think we take your point. Chairman Hill, do we have these dams in your project there? Is there a worry about how they might affect the water absorption, the sponge there that Steve was talking about, and the water filtration?
Yeah, no, that's definitely, a concern of, how these things are constructed. And I think in the particular uses in specific areas that would be appropriate. But again, it's really going through that evaluation of the site and where that water is building up and then how far that reaches. In many of the areas that we have restorations, there are some areas with deeper water, but the vast majority of it is quite shallow. And again, it is spreading that water across the landscape where it is held and slowly absorbed, and in parts recharging that aquifer, but then also in part, filtering that water. And then there's also water level control structures as well, that, a major storm event, so that things don't wash out and you have a very large environmental problem with, a failure of a structure. And so, these things are delicate, and we do our best to, help get things back as quickly as possible. And through that, the structures we've been able to put in place and has been allowed to bring things like wild rice back to our reservation, which again needs that particular type of clean water and situation to thrive, and we continue to encourage wildlife and also natural plantings of wetland species of grasses and trees in these areas, again, to try to assist nature to get back to its natural state.
And just in our last half a minute or so, Chairman Hill, if we look forward, say, 30 years or so, what are you hoping this project has accomplished by then?
Well, I think I believe it'll have a very positive impact, again, showing that partnership between all these different entities, whether it be the United Nations or the state or federal or even local environmentalists, that we can work together and mitigate some of these environmental challenges that have been created over the decades and create a possibility for clean water and healthy fish and healthy wildlife in many of these areas that have been subject to the detriment of human activity.
Chairman Hill, thanks for sharing the project with us today.
All right, you're welcome.
That's Tehasi Hill, chairman of the United Nations. He joined us for a look at an ongoing wetland restoration and conservation project in a watershed on tribal land west of Green Bay. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, with the economy continuing to recover and big federal spending along the way, an economist joins the show to look at concerns about inflation and how it could affect the prices we pay. The pandemic has had an impact on memory for a lot of people. A UW researcher joins the show to tell us what we know about what we remember. And we'll look at fact-checking in the transition from the Trump years to the Biden administration. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. yesterday on the show, we looked at daytime TV talk shows with the announcement that this season of The Ellen Show would be the last. We looked back at the history of daytime talk on TV. We got some stories from you on the phone and by email. Christine emailed us with her memories, quoting here. I remember when I got to stay home because I was sick and daytime TV was available to me. I got to watch it so rarely that it felt precious. I loved watching game shows like The Price is Right and talk shows like Oprah, Maury, and Jerry Springer. She goes on, it's not that it was the best television there was, but that it was almost like I got to access something special and rare. It's a very nostalgic thing to think about sitting on the sofa with a tummy ache, watching these shows home alone while all my friends were in school. Christine, thank you for sharing those memories. I had a lot of sick days when I was a kid. I was right there in front of the TV a lot of the time, too. And then Michael emailed a picture captioned Dave Garraway, J. Fred Muggs, and Phoebe B. Beebe, a human and two chimpanzees. I'd heard those names. I did a little digging back the 1950s, an early version of the Today Show featured a human host and J. Fred Muggs, a chimpanzee co-host slash mascot with occasional guest appearances from Phoebe, another chimp. Which makes my annual budget request for a Central Time chimpanzee a little less weird, doesn't it? But try telling that to the suits and management. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.